All right, we are in the book of 1 Kings. We're in 1 Kings 12 and 13. We're doing a study on the kings of Israel and Judah, and we are looking at Jeroboam. Just a quick review of where we finished up last week. King Jeroboam was an Ephraimite, so he was of the house of Joseph. He was initially placed over the house of Joseph by Solomon because he was an industrious man. And then later, God, through the prophet, told him that he would become the king because he was going to take the kingdom away from the house of Solomon, or because of Solomon's sin. When the people went to Rehoboam at his coronation and made their requests, Jeroboam was the spokesman. Well, then when Rehoboam unwisely refused their request, then Jeroboam became the first king of Israel, or of the northern tribes, at the division of the kingdom. Okay, so we left off talking about the golden calves that he made. And if you notice, I'm in 1 Kings, chapter number 13 is where we're going to be. No, I'm sorry, 1 Kings chapter 12. Look at the wrong side of the page here. 1 Kings chapter 12 and verse number 26. Jeroboam said in his heart, "Now shall the kingdom return to the house of David if this people go up to do sacrifice in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem. Then shall the heart of this people turn again unto their Lord, even unto Rehoboam king of Judah, and they shall kill me and go again to Rehoboam king of Judah." Whereupon the king took counsel and made two calves of gold and said unto them, "It is too much for you, Jerusalem. Behold thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt." And he set the one in Bethel, and the other put he in Dan. Now, if you have been paying attention as you read your Old Testament, that phrase there should sound really familiar. The end of verse 28, "Behold thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt." That's almost an exact quote of what Aaron said when he made the golden calf in the desert, in the wilderness, okay? So his reasoning, we talked about this last week, he said in his heart, so this was human reasoning. And yes, I think there is a connection to Aaron's golden calves, you know, just based on the terminology of what he said. But I do think also that there is a connection to ancient Semitic worship. Now remember, Semitic means what? All right, if you add an H in there, S-H-E-M, what would you have? Shemitic. And that's what Semitic means. It means referring to the people that descended from Shem. Okay? So the descendants of Shem were not just Israel. Okay? That was a whole group of people. Abraham, obviously, is a descendant of Shem. But where did Abraham originally come from? Ur of the Chaldees. Okay, which is modern day, you know, it was Babylon, later it was the region of Babylon, but you know, modern day Iraq, Iran. Okay, those people are of Semitic descent as well. But if we go all the way back to Babylon, I'm just going to list you some people groups here and some of their gods. Babylon, they worshiped Anu and Sin. You remember hearing maybe about the Temple of Sin and Marduk? Well, Marduk was represented with a calf. These pictures that I'm going to show you are different gods that were worshipped by different people groups that are all related to the Israelites or in the regions where they lived. Okay, the Babylonians had a god that was a cow or a calf. All right, now this is a representation of the god Baal. Actually, this first picture that I showed you here is a representation of the god Baal, believe it or not. Okay? This is another representation of Baal, and actually, if you see here, you have the body of a man and the head of a cow, if you can see that, on this ancient, you know, stone carving. That is from the land, the region of Israel as well, but the Babylonians, the Amorites had a god who stood on the back of a bull. Let me see here. Let's go to this one. You can see here there's a man riding on top of a cow. You can see that. All right, well, the Amorites had that. The Phoenicians that held the bull as a sacred animal. I mean, if we talk about a cow being sacred today, what country or group of people do you think of? India, right? And their religion. But that's not new. It's not, you know, unique, if I could say it that way. This is another representation of Baal, or, you know, Baal worship. You have the different symbols and stuff, but you have the cow featured there very prominently. In northern Syria, which is ancient land of the Hittites, they worship the cow. In not only Baal, who was representative of, you know, old-time God, but who was the female counterpart a lot of times in that region of the world? Ishtar, or Astarte, or Ashtoreth. Those are all synonyms for the same basic god. Well, she was worshipped, well, part of her symbol was a cow. So you have the bull for the male deity and the cow, the bull often representing both power and fertility. I mean, one good, strong bull, you could, you know, strengthen a herd, you know, and multiply your herd greatly. This is a statue of Baal as well. But if you remember, I realize this is not an infallible source of information, but when I put in images of Baal into Google and hit go, this was on the top line of what came up. Now, that ought to look a little bit familiar, right? I mean, for those of you that have been here for the study, when we talked about Molech and we talked about human sacrifice, remember, body of a man, head of a cow or a bull? Interesting. Sometimes you see this in the news from time to time, but groups that say, well, if you can have, you know, Christian clubs in the public schools, then the Satan worshipers ought to be able to have one too. You see that from time to time in the news. You ever see the symbol that they want to put up for that? Body of a man, head of an animal, sometimes with cows, sometimes more like goat horns. Okay? But what I'm saying is there's a tremendous connection here. The more you look at history, the more you see, okay, there's nothing really new under the sun. But this was an image of Baal that came up. Now, if you remember when we talked about Molech, the abomination of the Ammonites, and who was the other one? That was the two descendants of Lot, Ammon, and I can't remember the other one. Anyway, but this was, you know, one of the idols that we looked at, and it was the body of a man, head of an animal, and, you know, they would place human sacrifice right on that. There would be a fire built inside of it. This one's a little easier to see, but there would be a fire built in beneath. They would place the child on the arms of that, and it would often kind of roll right back into the fire. Okay, the gods that were worshipped by human sacrifice, very, very often they had the head of a cow and the body of a man. Okay, the Babylonians had this. The Amorites worshipped a cow. The Phoenicians, which would be Tyre and Sidon, so that's north of Israel, held the bull as a sacred animal. The Hittites in northern Syria held the bull as sacred. Not only Baal was the a cow or a bull connected with Baal worship, it was also a symbol for Ishtar or Astarte. Okay, in the land of Canaan, the Semitic Canaanites, which would have been, you know, relatives of Israel, but they weren't descendants of Abraham. Okay, the Semitic Canaanites, their symbol of Baal was a bull, and then Astarte or Ishtar, the symbol was a cow. Okay, now, in Egypt, one of the sacred animals was a cow as well. And, you know, often when you hear talk about Aaron's golden calf, there's talk about a connection with idolatrous worship in Egypt, and there is that. But the god Sin of Ur was represented as a bull, and Anu as a heifer, okay? So what I'm trying to show you is that it wasn't necessarily just Egypt. What I want you to see is that in that region of the world, if you think about, you know, the Fertile Crescent, so to speak, which ends over in, you know, Iraq, Iran today, But that whole region of what today would be Iraq, Iran, Syria, into Turkey, down into Israel and Egypt, that whole region of the world, their false gods, they used a bull or a cow in some form or another in their idolatry in a widespread fashion. In fact, what is called, you know, by one name in Babylon might have been basically the same worship by the Hittites in Palestine. They just had a different name for it. But the characteristics of the god were pretty much the same. The rituals for worship were pretty much the same. It is very interesting to see how this all overlaps. But so was there a connection when Jeroboam decides to make the idols to be calves? So he's going to make a cow or a bull statue. Was this coincidental? Not at all. Okay? This goes way back, you know, prior to Abraham, prior to God bringing Abraham to Palestine, you know, prior to Israel ever being established as a nation in the land. I mean, you're talking about hundreds of years of history with ancestors and so forth. That whole region of the world, their form of idolatry included symbols of a cow or a bull. Okay? So, this was not, hey, let's just try something new. You know, what I want you to see is this symbol was something that they had seen. I mean, they had seen it in Egypt. They had seen it in Canaan. And so what he tried to do then was to connect this symbol with the name Jehovah. Okay? In chapter 12, he said, you know, behold your gods. I lost my place here. 28, there we go. Behold thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. Well, who was the God that brought them out of the land of Egypt? It was Jehovah. Okay? And so he tries to make these calves the visual symbol of Jehovah. Now, obviously, that breaks some other commandments. But, yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah. Mm. That is one of the things that I have learned, you know, in really digging into Jeroboam a little bit more, is that the more things change, the more they stay the same. Okay? Sometimes it's just like products. Slap a different label on it, but the product and the package is the same. You know, they put a different name on it, but it's the same thing. There are a few basic root ideas to replace the God of creation with, and those have gotten different labels and different names. One of the explanations that I read that made a lot of sense to me, so as far as why a bull, you know, or why a cow, was that very often these pagan peoples were fascinated with what they called the source of life or the power of life. I mean, is that not the essence of a lot of the world religions today? The higher power, the source of life, the fountain of youth, you know, that life-giving power, right? Well, if you're not going to acknowledge the God of heaven as the creator, then you have to attribute that power to some other source, okay? And so the bull and the cow were often symbolic. You know, like I said, a bull, you could put a bull in a herd with good stock and multiply your herd in a relatively short amount of time. And so that became symbolic of life-giving power. Obviously, we know that came from God, okay? But that is also why prostitution and immorality eventually became associated with this worship. You know, the process of life and so forth. But all of this that I'm saying is that, yes, Jeroboam's calves harken back to Aaron, and Aaron's had a connection to Egypt, but that's not the only connection. I mean, this was widespread in the land of their ancestors, if I could say it this way. So I guess the other thing that I would caution against is this. Don't assume that because you haven't struggled with whatever your parents or grandparents struggled with, that you're immune to it. Okay? I mean, there are times when a certain particular temptation is stronger for some people than it is for others. My grandfather, before he got saved, was what I would call a functional alcoholic. Never beat his family, never abused people at all, but he was at the bar drinking beer nights and weekends. My dad, as a teenager, and then when he went into the military, was the same way until he got saved. Okay? So I can't say, that was them. I'm not going to say, I must be aware and say, all right, I've not messed with the stuff, but I'm not going to try it just to prove that I'm better than that. I'm scared to death. I take one or two, and then all of a sudden I'm hooked, right? Okay, I don't want to mess with that. And what I'm saying is that don't assume because you haven't struggled with something that in your lifetime that you're immune to it. Okay. On the flip side, don't apologize for guarding your children against things that you know to be major pitfalls and problems. Okay. That if you know, all right, this is what it did to me, or this is what it did to people that I have observed, my friends, my coworkers, whatever, okay? I'm not advocating being unnecessarily harsh, but be willing to be accused of being the mean parent. If you know, all right, this is a pitfall that tends to get its hooks in people. We use the terminology sometimes from Hebrews of besetting sin, the sin which does so easily beset us. The idea is not that we're passive, but rather it's a trick that we fall for over and over and over again. Okay, it's a trap that we step into. Okay, a besetting sin is something that, tends to keep popping up, but that doesn't mean that we bear no responsibility. Okay, it's not that we're passive in this. What I'm saying is that idolatry was a besetting sin for Israel, was it not? Was that not something that they fell into over and over and over and over again? I mean, one of the reasons God brought Abraham out of Ur was he said, I want you from your kindred and from your family and from your father's house and also from all that idolatrous worship. Now, I want to be your God and I want to have your attention. Okay? God also said of Abraham, I know how he will command his house after him. The household of Abraham was worshipers of God. The household worshiped God. But their extended family, if I could say it that way, that was always a temptation. I mean, what did Lot get into when he got into Sodom? And you just go on and on and on down the line. But I think there was kind of a connection with something that was already familiar to them when he made golden calves. This was already a temptation that it wasn't that hard to talk them into. And don't forget, who has already laid the foundation and opened the gates to idolatrous worship prior to Jeroboam? Solomon. Solomon is the one that introduced idolatry into Israel. He built the high places for the gods of his foreign wives, and Solomon has cracked this thing wide open. So I showed you the pictures. Babylon, here's it in text form. Other nations who had a bull or a cow as symbols of their worship, Babylon, both the god Sin and the god Marduk were represented in some form. The Amorites, the Phoenicians, which is northern Syria today, the Hittites, again in Babylon with Ishtar, the flip side of that, also in Arabia, Moab, Phoenicia, Syria, they also worshipped Ishtar or Astarte, different names. The Canaanites, Baal was represented as a bull and Astarte as a cow. Okay? So when we talk about the Baal worship with, say, Ahab and Jezebel, I mean, that was only a half step away from the calf worship of Jeroboam. I mean, Jeroboam said, here's a calf and it represents Jehovah that brought you out of Egypt. They said, well, this is really Baal. There was very much a connection all over with the Canaanites and also the Egyptians. Okay? So when Jeroboam chose the symbol of calves, this was not something brand new nobody had ever heard of. This was a borrowed thing. Yes, sir. I think that'd probably be a good term for it, Brother Ivan. You know, if you didn't hear him, he said, would this be syncretism? And all of you are like, what is syncretism? Okay. Syncretism, are you familiar with the term to synchronize? Okay, what is, if we say let's synchronize our watches, that used to be a thing before they were, you know, you had cell phones and they automatically got updated off cell phone towers, right? You know, but to synchronize means to bring into agreement or to bring into harmony, okay? To synchronize means to work together, right? Well, syncretism is kind of related to that, but syncretism is the idea of bringing a piece from one religion and a piece from another religion and a piece from another religion and bringing it together. Or, if I could say it this way, you have your religion, but you adopt pieces of other things that of the culture of with which people are already familiar to convince them that what you're bringing in isn't really all that different. It's just kind of maybe a souped up version. You may or may not see that in the United States, but that's what the Catholic Church has done all over the world. You talk to Jed Duarte in Brazil, talk to Brother Lockhart about the things that they saw in Brazil. I mean, the idols, and even in Brazil, there's a very strong influence of Pentecostalism and, you know, the prosperity theology kind of thing. So the Catholic Church has kind of adopted that prosperity theology into there. That would be one example. You know, there are others. Guess what? You see these bumper stickers sometimes with the coexist, with all the different religious symbols. That would be an example of syncretism, trying to take a piece of this and a piece of this and a piece of this, and if I could say it this way, make a religious casserole. You know, it's not, okay, I got my meat here and my vegetables here and my salad here, and if you're like me, those things stay separate. I eat all of my vegetables and then all of my salad and then all of, you know, I watch my mom and she's like, bite of this, just kind of working her way all the way around the plate. I don't do it that way, okay? It's too much work for me to do it now, but when I was a kid and I had mixed vegetables, I would separate it. Pile of carrots, pile of green beans, pile of corn, then I would eat the piles, you know. So my granddaddy, on my mom's side, this is total sidetrack, but anyway, we talked about casserole. My granddaddy didn't want casserole in the house. And I eat one thing at a time. My granddad only put one thing on his plate at the time. But the only thing that was an exception to that was a biscuit to sop up the gravy or to push with if you needed it, you know. But so a casserole is where you take all of it and mix it. You know, there's certain casseroles I don't mind. I don't mind broccoli casserole or, you know, things like that. But, you know, if you're going to try to take all of it, you know, your meat, your cheese, your rice, your broccoli, whatever, put it all in one dish, I mean, I'll eat it, but it's not my favorite. Okay? But syncretism would be a religious casserole. We got a little bit of this, a little bit of this, a little bit of this. We mix it all up into one pot, and, you know, here's your serving of religion. Okay, so yes, this is kind of an adoption of other religions being absorbed into what was supposed to be the worship of God. Now, he's already deviated from two major commands. One command God gave Israel and said, when I put you in a land, I will pick a spot and you'll put my house there. Okay, well, now he said, all right, I'm going to pick a different spot. Okay, what was the other, you know, from what we call the Ten Commandments? Yeah, no other gods before me, no graven image. So really, there's two there, okay? So, I mean, we're way off the rails here, and Israel should have known better. But if Solomon brought this in, then Jeroboam's kind of building off of that foundation. It's easier to understand why some people went along with it. Okay, Brother Phil? I got some others I want you to teach that too about not being a bad influence. I think Brother Phil's brought out an interesting tendency of the human heart, and that part I would agree with. I don't know that I could go with the Kansas City Royals, go Braves, but anyway. There is a tendency in the human heart to hero worship, or sometimes they're called our idols, right, or our heroes. There is a tendency, which, you know, I was thinking of, you know, thou shalt not make any graven image earlier, but, you know, Tammy mentioned, thou shalt have no other gods before me. I mean, the bottom line is this: if you don't worship God, you will worship somebody or something. Okay, that's the way we're wired. Okay, we're wired to worship and respect and to look for help outside of our own abilities and that kind of thing. Some people worship themselves, you know, to a large degree, and by, you know, self-reliance and so forth. But we are wired to worship somebody or something. Jeroboam here was afraid that, all right, if I let them keep going to Jerusalem, then they're going to want to go back to the household of David. So Jeroboam builds the calves, plays on the weakness of the human heart, but he also plainly disobeys God. Now, if you remember, I pointed this out last time. God had appeared to Jeroboam and said, if you will obey me, I'll establish your kingdom forever, right? So ultimately, Jeroboam decided that he trusted his own ideas more than he trusted God's promise. Okay? Now, where did he put these calves? Dan and Bethel. Okay? Dan was in the far north. Sometimes you read the expression from Dan to Beersheba, which is from the extreme north to the extreme south of Israel's territory, you know, when they originally got the land. But Dan was in the far north. If for those of you that really paid attention, when you read the book of Judges, there was some, you know, from the tribe of Dan that found a guy that had an idol in his house, and they took his Levite and his idol, and they went up north, said, you want to be a priest to one house? You want to be a priest to a whole tribe? I mean, Dan was idolatrous, you know, way back then, you know, long before David. But Dan was in the far north. They said, we need more land. And Joshua said, all right, well, there's land up north in the mountains. Go, you know, kill those people and cut down trees and build what you need to build and that kind of thing. But then Bethel was in the south of the divide of the northern section there. Bethel was just north of Jerusalem, okay? So when the kingdom divided and Judah, it's referred to as Judah, Benjamin was pretty much surrounded land-wise by Judah, okay? But just north of Jerusalem a little ways was Bethel. Now, Bethel, anybody remember other instances where Bethel was mentioned in the Old Testament? Jacob, yeah, well, that's where it got the name Bethel. In Genesis 28, Jacob was going back, you know, he's running from Esau, but he's going back to take a wife. You know, and he has the dream of that. We call it Jacob's ladder, but it's a ladder going up and down to heaven, and angels going up and down. And he called it Bethel or Beth-El. Beth is the Hebrew word for house. El is the short form of Elohim, the name of God. Okay? So Bethel is literally house of God. And the Bible says there in Genesis 28, but formerly it was called Luz. And then he changed the name to Bethel. Okay? In Genesis chapter 12, Abraham had pitched his tent there at Bethel long before Jacob renamed it. In Judges chapter 21, I didn't put that one on here, but in Judges 21, that was the site of the annual feast. That's one of my favorite stories in the book of Judges. If you think Seven Brides for Seven Brothers is an original story, you haven't read the Bible. Okay? There was a Levite. His concubine ran away. He went to get her. You know, they stopped at this certain city in Gibeah, and they abused her. It was very much reminiscent of Sodom. And so then he cut her in pieces and sent the pieces all over as a call to war. So they go to war, right? And then they all said, none of us will ever give any of our daughters to marry them. Well, then when the battle's over, they're like, man, we nearly wiped out a whole tribe here. What do we do? Well, there were a few young girls that had not been married, and they gave them as wives to the tribe that had nearly been wiped out, you know, from different sources. And then, there were still about 200 that needed wives. So they said, all right, here's what you do. Up in Bethel and Shiloh, in that area, there was an annual feast, and there's a dance. It said, hide out in the bushes, and when the young virgins come out to the ceremonial dance, catch one and steal your wife. Okay, that's what they, so you thought Seven Brides for Seven Brothers was an original story. It's not. Okay? You thought speed dating was a new concept. It's not. Okay? So you know, the calculations there are very interesting. I mean, obviously, you've got to pick one up that you can carry. So, you know, eat cupcakes. It's for your own protection. That's what I'm saying. Okay. But that was the same region of Bethel. Wow, we've really gone off the rails today. Talk about somebody you need to teach to behave better. Maybe it starts with me. But in 1 Samuel chapter 7, Bethel was one of the three sites where Samuel made a circuit. He had three spots where he would go and the people would come to him. He would judge the people. He would teach them God's law and so forth. Bethel was a part of that. So Bethel, historically, had been associated with the worship of God. It had been associated with God's work and God's appearance and so forth. And then Jeroboam co-opts that. He co-opted the calf thing from, you know, pagan worship. He co-opts the site of Bethel from, you know, its previous connections with appearances of God. And so now he's got one in the south and one in the north. So what was one of his major selling points here? And look again in 1 Kings 12 and verse number 28. Wherefore the king took counsel, made two calves of gold, and said to them, "It is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem." What does that sound like? Can I put it in modern day terms? Seeker sensitive, user friendly, convenient. He said, it's too much effort to worship God the way he said. So here, I've got you a simpler, easier option. You could watch the live stream when you're perfectly healthy and have no other reason instead of getting dressed and go to church. You know, I'm sorry, I quit preaching and going to meddling. But he offered them a religion of convenience. See, he said, look, these are your gods that brought you up out of Egypt. This is going to be closer and more convenient. It was all lies. It really was his invention to preserve his kingdom. Okay, so obviously then, what happens? Well, God's not going to bless that. You see, he introduces the calves. Look in with me in chapter 12 and verse 32. Jeroboam ordained a feast in the eighth month on the 15th day of the month, like unto the feast that is in Judah. Now, there's a couple students in here that ought to remember this, but I won't put them on the spot. But there were, you know, several feasts of Judah. Well, one of them, well, the seventh month, there were three. At the beginning of the month was the Feast of Trumpets. That was to synchronize the calendars because their calendar was based on the moon. And so if you had cloudy days for two or three days, sometimes it was hard to know exactly when the full moon happened and the new cycle started over. But there was the Feast of Trumpets, which is kind of a call to prepare. Then seventh month, 10th day of the month, was the Day of Atonement, the highest holy day on the Jewish calendar. And then seventh month, 15th day of the month, was the Feast of Tabernacles. So after the atonement was made, then there was a time of rejoicing where the tabernacles reminded them of the temporary dwellings they'd lived in when they came out of Egypt and now how God's blessed them, God's established them in their land and all of that. That was the Feast of Tabernacles. Well, that was seventh month, 15th day of the month. So what did he do? He copied it. Oh, we're going to have a feast, eighth month, 15th day of the month. What do you call it? I don't know. It doesn't matter. Okay. But it's a copycat. I mean, how many things in false religions are copied from the Bible? A lot. How much error has to be introduced before it's problematic? Not much. Okay? But he invented his own feast here in verse 32. Look at verse number 32 again. The eighth month, 15th day of the month, like the feast that is in Judah, and he offered on the altar. So did he in Bethel, sacrificing unto the calves that he had made. And he placed in Bethel priests of the high places which he had made. Okay, so he's also replacing the priesthood. In verse number 33, he offered on the altar which he had made in Bethel the 15th day of the eighth month, even in the month which he devised of his own heart. And he ordained a feast unto the children of Israel. And he burnt offer. He offered on the altar and burnt incense. So you have a counterfeit priesthood. Look with me in chapter 13 for just a minute. Chapter 13 and verse number 33. After this thing, Jeroboam returned not from his evil way, but he made of the lowest of the people priests, and of the high priests of the high places, whosoever would, he consecrated him, and he became one of the priests of the high places. So he not only had a counterfeit worship, he had a counterfeit priesthood, which we'll get to at the end of chapter 13, but I wanted to tie it in together today. Okay. He said in his heart, I'm going to lose these people. What had God said? If you follow me, I'll establish your kingdom forever. He trusted his own reasoning over God's promise. So then he builds the golden calves, playing off of their historic weaknesses and idolatry. And then he sets up his own priesthood. Eventually what you're going to see is because the Levites were not only fed and supported, they were not welcome. Eventually they all migrated to the south, to the temple, which ultimately helped Judah last longer because there was more salt preserving influence, if I could say it that way. So that ultimately helped the southern kingdom last longer. The southern kingdom also eventually went into idolatry, just not quite as fast. Okay? But he ordained his own houses of worship, his own idols, his own priests. It was all, a huge mess. All right? So that brings us then in 1 Kings chapter 13, verse number 1, there came a man of God out of Judah by the word of the Lord unto Bethel, and Jeroboam stood by the altar to burn incense. Now, there are times when we read this passage and don't connect it historically, right? This is the prophet that says, God's against you, and God's going to judge you. And he tells his men, seize that man. And God causes his arm to freeze, and he couldn't draw it back in again. Please heal my hand. And he did. Well, that was Jeroboam. Well, why Bethel? Because that was one of his two worship sites. Okay? But God sent a prophet to rebuke him. He still wouldn't listen. He knew better. See, God would have allowed some measure of reprieve if he would have repented. Rehoboam did repent, and, Solomon did repent to an extent, and their judgment was lessened. But there's another tendency of the human heart to say, well, I've already made my decision. I may as well write it out instead of saying, look, let me salvage what I can. Jeroboam refused to do that. He hardened his heart. But Jeroboam built on the foundation that Solomon laid. Solomon laid the foundation of idolatry in Israel, built high places for the gods that his many wives had worshipped in their home countries. Well, now Rehoboam is building on that, but this was also drawing on Egypt and Canaan and Phoenicia and Syria and Babylon. I mean, this was all connected. This thing never went away. I'm getting ahead of myself, but that's okay, because by next week, most of you won't remember it anyway. But from here on out, the kings were all compared to Jeroboam. He departed not away from the sins of Jeroboam. He followed the sins of Jeroboam. In some cases, the kings of the south followed the sins of Jeroboam. What I'm saying is Jeroboam could have set a trail for good. He could have established a positive legacy. In essence, there's two comparisons. He'd followed after the way of David if he was a good king, or he followed after the sins of Jeroboam if he was an idolatrous king. Okay? Jeroboam had a choice. He could have trusted God and worshiped God. He chose his own reasoning, and where did it lead him? To, not to exaltation and blessing, but rather to being a byword, if you will, and a warning, and to a loss of God's blessing. All right, we've got to quit there for today. Let's close in a word of prayer. Thank you, Lord.